Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. 50 years ago, the Chinese Communist Party started the country down a path to the Cultural Revolution. The party said the campaign would bring about a more just society in China. But in reality, it led to complete social and economic disaster. On May 16, 1966, Chinese Communist Party Chairman Mao Zedong launched the Cultural Revolution by ousting several top party officials. Mao also announced plans to return power to the working class. What followed was not the workers' state he had planned. Instead, the country experienced violence, food shortages, and economic hardship. The Cultural Revolution led to the oppression and deaths of millions of Chinese. Now, it seems as if the government would like to forget the Cultural Revolution. There were no official events held on Monday. No newspapers in mainland China noted the anniversary. Instead, China's largest papers published stories about American businessman Donald Trump and Chinese government reaction to a U.S. military report. Roderick McFarker is with Harvard University in Massachusetts. He is an expert on the Cultural Revolution. He told The Guardian newspaper that China's current president, Xi Jinping, is looking to avoid any uncomfortable facts about the revolution. McFarker said the really uncomfortable fact, which Xi Jinping cannot really stomach, is Mao's role in the Cultural Revolution. Mao actually enjoyed the chaos. He loved the idea of civil war. Mao Zedong urged young people in China to join his Red Guard paramilitary group. He told them to attack the four olds in Chinese society: customs, culture, habits, and ideas. Many Red Guard members were students. They tortured teachers and other school officials in public. The students even turned in their own parents to the government for expressing anti-government ideas. Thousands of people were beaten to death. Many others were driven to suicide. The violence and hardship started to end when Mao died in 1976. It took another 5 years for China's government to comment on his policies. The government said the policies led to domestic turmoil and brought catastrophe to the party, the state, and the whole people. What Mao did during the Cultural Revolution is still a hard subject to debate in China. There has been a return to his ideas in recent years. Mao has found support among the old and poor members of Chinese society. They like to remember the time when the state provided for them and society was more equal.
After declaring a state of emergency, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, threatened to seize closed factories and arrest their owners. At a rally over the weekend, Maduro told supporters that owners of closed factories are trying to sabotage the country. And he accused the United States of trying to destabilize Venezuela. The state of emergency gives Maduro increased powers for 60 days. Venezuela's economy has been severely affected by low oil prices. Venezuela is a member of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and a major oil producer. Yet the lack of trade in oil means the country is having a hard time paying for imported materials it needs. Last month, the country's largest food and drink distributor, Polar, shut down its last beer plant. The company said it is unable to get hard currency to buy raw materials. The political opposition in Venezuela now says an effort to recall the Venezuelan leader is gaining traction. Anti-government activists say they have collected 1.8 million of the 4 million signatures required to force a recall vote of the president. On Saturday, thousands of protesters appeared in the streets of Caracas in support of a recall referendum. However, if the Venezuelan president is removed, his vice president would take the top office. Latin America analyst Mark Jones of Rice University recently spoke to VOA about the economic situation in Venezuela. He said the South American country, once a thriving oil producer, is collapsing economically.
Inflation is approaching 1,000% annually. The economy is going to shrink by probably around 10% this year. It's a country that is economically destitute.
Jones added that political tensions in the country are very high. The analyst noted that Maduro and Hugo Chavez before him mismanaged Venezuela's economy. The current situation, he suggested, would not be too different if oil prices were high.
Now, they might be able to be riding out this storm a little easier if oil was at $100 a barrel. But even back when oil was at $100 a barrel, the country was experiencing shortages.
I'm Katie Weaver.
A new report shows Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton running a close race in Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. The report from Quinnipiac University was considered important news, even though it described voter opinions in just 3 of the 50 U.S. states. The reason? Because how people vote in those 3 states could decide who becomes president. The American presidential election is now centered on a shrinking number of battleground states to decide the winner, said Eric Ostermeyer, a political scientist at the University of Minnesota. These battleground states are called swing states, meaning that sometimes their voters choose a Democratic candidate and sometimes a Republican. The media focus so much on these states because of how Americans elect their president. Americans go to the polls to vote for president on November 8th, but the candidate with the most votes does not automatically win. The winner is decided by the 538 members of the Electoral College. The Electoral College does not have any students or teachers. Instead, it is a group of people who represent their states in the U.S. presidential contest. Each state has the same number of members in the Electoral College that they have representatives in Congress. That number is decided by the state's population. States with the smallest numbers, including Alaska and Vermont, have 3 members of the Electoral College. The state with the largest number, California, has 55. The U.S. Constitution, which established the Electoral College system, does not require members of the Electoral College to vote for the candidate who won the popular vote in their states, but they almost always do. As a result, in most states, candidates do not benefit more by winning a larger percentage of the popular vote. So, if 99% of voters in California select Hillary Clinton, she will receive all of California's 55 votes in the Electoral College. If only 51% of voters in California select Hillary Clinton, she will still receive all of California's 55 Electoral College votes. In all but 2 states, whether they win by 1% or 20%, candidates still get the same number of Electoral College votes. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Kenya is planning to close the world's largest refugee camp, which it says poses a security threat that could lead to terrorist attacks. An estimated 330,000 refugees will be affected when the Dadaab camp in northeast Kenya is shut down. Most refugees there are from Somalia, who escaped conflict in their country. Kenya's government announced plans to close the camp within the shortest time possible. But the United Nations and international human rights groups have criticized the move. The UN Refugee Agency urged Kenya this week to reconsider its decision. The agency said in a statement that closing the camp would have devastating consequences. It urged the government to avoid taking any action that might be at odds with its international obligations. Kenya's Interior Minister, Joseph Nkasiri, said at a news conference Wednesday that the camp threatens Kenya's security. He said the government believes the camp harbors extremists from Somalia's Islamic Al-Shabaab group and is used to smuggle weapons. Al-Shabaab has carried out several major terror attacks in Kenya. In 2013, an attack on a Nairobi mall killed 67 people. A 2015 attack on a college in the town of Garissa left 148 people dead. Al-Shabaab began launching attacks in Kenya after Kenyan troops entered Somalia to fight the militant group in 2011. Kenya's government has admitted that closing the refugee camps will harm refugees. It urged the international community to take steps to minimize the pain and suffering. Human Rights Watch senior refugee researcher Jerry Simpson says refugees are not the source of security threats in Kenya. Simpson said that in the cases of both the mall and university attacks, Somali nationals who came directly from Somalia were charged with the terror offenses, not registered refugees. But Interior Ministry spokesman Muenda Njoka disagrees, saying that terrorists have used refugee camps to plan and train for attacks. Government and security expert Mumo Nzau agrees that terrorists have infiltrated the camps and that the camps do pose a security risk. But he is calling for a careful approach to dealing with the situation. He said one option would be to relocate the camps. Kenya and Somalia signed an agreement with the United Nations Refugee Agency in 2013 to voluntarily repatriate Somali refugees. As Somalia has slowly recovered from years of conflict, the Dadaab camp population decreased from more than 500,000 refugees to 350,000. The United Nations said it planned to repatriate 50,000 more refugees this year, but officials admitted this repatriation would be a difficult task because the Somali government is still fighting an insurgency from al-Shabaab. Kenya, which has been hosting refugees for nearly 25 years, previously threatened to close the camps but did not follow through. The group Human Rights Watch noted that politicians often bring up the refugee issue during election cycles. Elections in Kenya are set for next year. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The lives of rich people seem to be getting better and better. Rich people generally have better homes than poor people. They usually have better jobs and better schools for their children, too. Now, a new study finds that the rich may even have better stress than poor people. Stress is the way the brain reacts to any kind of demand or threat. The American Psychological Association says it is part of our body's fight-or-flight response. When faced with danger, stress can create energy to fight off an attacker. It makes the body release hormones that increase our heart rate and blood pressure. That is the stress of ancient times. In modern times, stress can help you give a great presentation at work or win a sporting event. This is short-term stress that leads to success in accomplishing a goal. This is a good kind of stress, and it is the stress that most rich people have. But many problems with life or work can cause stress. Stressors are the bills that you can't pay, the childcare that falls through at the last minute, or the car that won't start. These stressors add to what experts call chronic stress. According to a new survey, this is the stress facing many poor people in the United States. The Brookings Institution, a public policy group, reported the finding. The APA website notes that chronic stress can affect a person's mental and physical health. When people deal with these chronic stressors every day, their fight or flight response is stuck in the on position. And chronic stress is poor people stress. Poor people often experience stressful conditions beyond their control. If one thing goes wrong in their day, like a flat tire or picking up a sick child from school, their lives can spiral out of control. This can create a huge amount of chronic stress. For some people, there is often no light at the end of the tunnel. The day-to-day stress never lets up, and it wears the body down. It harms the natural defenses against disease, puts pressure on the heart, makes muscles tired, and can cause depression. Besides causing physical issues, chronic day-to-day stress can lead to other problems. It is difficult to plan for tomorrow when you can barely make ends meet today. Poor people often do not have time, energy, or resources to plan and successfully complete long-term goals. The daily grind of life can make it more difficult to attend college classes at night in hopes of getting a better job. Rich people also have stress and face difficulties, but their situations are very different. Rich people's stress is often linked to career advancement. It is short-term stress that helps lead them to a long-term goal. Of course, rich people can have terrible things happen to them, but they are usually better prepared. They usually have better life insurance policies. They may have more professional contacts that often reach far back to college and even high school. These connections can help them get another job should they lose the one they have. People with money usually have better doctors and medical care than poor people. If a family member develops a drug dependency, for example, a person with money can send them to a drug treatment center. The rich also have access to support that poor people often don't. A poor person may worry a lot about a child getting poor grades in school. A rich person can pay a tutor to help their child. In other words, wealthy people can throw money at their problems. This can greatly reduce stress. It is important to note that chronic stress can be a problem among poor people in the United States. In other countries, the poor may not experience the same kind of stress. I'm Anna Mateo.
The United States government says transgender students have a right to use restrooms that agree with their chosen sexual identity. The Obama administration sent a letter containing its guidance to all U.S. public school districts last week. The letter was signed by Justice and Education Department leaders. School district officials also received a statement from Attorney General Loretta Lynch. It said, "There is no room in our schools for discrimination of any kind, including discrimination against transgender students on the basis of their sex." Lynch said, "The guidance gives school administrators, teachers, and parents the tools they need to protect transgender students from peer harassment and to identify and address unjust school policies." The letter said that public schools are required to treat transgender students in a way that agrees with their gender identity. It said, "This is a requirement even when a different sex is listed on a student's education records or identity documents." The letter said that schools may not require transgender students to have a medical exam before treating them according to their chosen gender identity. North Carolina is the first state that bars people from using large bathrooms in public buildings that do not match the gender on their birth certificate. Attorney General Lynch called the North Carolina law state-sponsored discrimination. She said it reminded her of a time when African Americans were barred from public buildings and when states could decide who is permitted to marry. The federal government's case names the state government, Governor Pat McCrory, the Department of Public Safety, and the University of North Carolina. McCrory and other supporters of the law say it is necessary to protect privacy in public bathrooms
and guard against men using women's restrooms to spy on women. But Lynch said the state invented a problem that does not exist, so it can discriminate against and threaten people. I'm Ann Ball.
An art project in Turkey is bringing together people divided along ethnic and religious lines. 24 Kurdish and Turkish young adults have worked together to create documentaries and photographs about life in Turkish cities. The results are now on display in the southern Turkish city of Diyarbakir. The art project is called BAK. Latif Yulusiner is the coordinator. People, especially young people, living in different parts of Turkey don't know each other, she said. Face-to-face meeting is important. We want to give some possibilities to these young people to experience the city. The project members chose the following issues: the 1923 population exchange between Greece and Turkey, Roma people, and the tattoo culture. Many works also featured the Kurds' years-long battle for minority rights. Zilan, a video documentary, recalls a massacre of thousands of Kurds and the exile of many more by the Turkish state in the 1930s. I found out that many killed were relatives of mine. The affected villages were very familiar, said co-director Daria Gumish. I met people who survived. They were the last witnesses. Even though I lived there, I learned it very late as well, so I wanted to tell this. Gumish admits that working with a partner from a different background was not always easy. Her partner was originally from the Black Sea region, but now studies in the western city of Izmir, which is one of the main hubs for refugees seeking to enter Europe. That experience, Gumish says, helped to provide common ground. Overcoming ethnic divides between partners became harder when fighting between the PKK Kurdish rebel group and the Turkish government resumed last July. Diyarbakir, one of the BAK host cities, witnessed some of the worst fighting. The conflict affected some projects. For example, the Resort of the East, Hazar, aimed to show an aspect of Kurdish life rarely seen, normality. Photographer Murat Kartel said he and his partner wanted to show the holiday habits of the region. But, he said, the growing violence caused problems. I saw that our efforts could be in vain, he said. The clashes started, and I questioned this. What am I doing here? When we finish this project and exhibit these photographs, we see the preciousness of peace. Many observers warn that the deepening ethnic conflict, especially among the young, presents Turkey with one of its greatest challenges. But those who participated in BAK say they took a small step in bridging that ethnic divide. I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.